From PRX, this is Living on Earth. I'm Jenny Doring.
And I'm Paloma Beltran. A study examines the climate toll of liquefied natural gas, or LNG.
Natural gas is mostly methane. You can't develop and use that without having some of it emitted unburned to the atmosphere. And small amounts, you know, a couple of percent of the fuel emitted unburned to the atmosphere add hugely to the greenhouse gas consequences.
Also, gifts sent by U.S. mail this holiday season could be delivered in a brand new EV.
The duty of delivering mail is perfect for electric vehicles because it's a lot of stop and go, and that allows you to use regenerative braking, and your range would be pretty good. For EVs, this is the perfect use case, actually.
That and more this week on Living on Earth. Stick around. From PRX and the Jennifer and Ted Stanley Studios at the University of Massachusetts Boston, this is Living on Earth. I'm Jenny Doring.
And I'm Paloma Beltran. When you fire up your gas range to cook dinner, the natural gas that's delivered through pipes to your stove is, well, a gas. But more and more of the natural gas the U.S. produces is destined for overseas, so it can't just travel as gas through pipelines. Instead, it's compressed into LNG, or liquefied natural gas, so it can be loaded onto tankers and shipped across the ocean. And because of its high carbon footprint, LNG has become one of the most intensely debated energy issues. After facing pressure from climate activists, in early 2024, the Biden administration put a temporary pause on the permitting of new liquefied natural gas export facilities. That decision was swiftly challenged in court by a coalition of Republican-led states and has been in litigation for months. Meanwhile, President-elect Donald Trump campaigned on increasing oil and gas drilling, as well as approving export permits for new liquefied natural gas projects. And according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, LNG exports from North America are on track to more than double in the next 4 years. This expansion could be disastrous for the climate, according to a recent paper out of Cornell University that found the carbon footprint of U.S. LNG exports is 33% higher than for coal. Author Robert Howarth is a professor of ecology and environmental biology at Cornell, and he joins me now. Robert, welcome to Living on Earth.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you today.
So, Robert, your study looked at the carbon footprint of liquefied natural gas. What did it find?
I looked at how liquefied natural gas exported from the United States compares in terms of natural gas used in the United States and also with other fossil fuels that could be used in destination countries in terms of their greenhouse gas consequences. And the conclusion is that the greenhouse gas footprint of liquefied natural gas is probably the worst of any fossil fuel. It's certainly worse than natural gas used domestically. It's also worse than that of coal in most countries.
So how is liquefied natural gas produced and transported? What does the process look like?
It's a heavily, heavily industrialized process with large amounts of carbon dioxide emissions, but also large amount of methane emissions. LNG is natural gas. It's shale gas, mostly from the United States. That is methane. And methane is an incredibly potent greenhouse gas. It's more than 100 times more powerful than carbon dioxide for the time it's in the atmosphere. So small emissions of methane as we produce the shale gas and as we liquefy to LNG and as it's burned by the tankers, those add up to significantly increase the greenhouse gas footprint over what you'd have just for carbon dioxide.
So natural gas is often seen as a bridge fuel, but your study found that liquefied natural gas has a huge carbon footprint. Why is that?
Let's go back and look at the concept of whether natural gas is a bridge fuel at all. That idea originated 25 years ago. It really came out of the marketing folks, the public relations folks in big oil and gas. And there's an element of truth in it. If you compare the carbon dioxide emissions when you burn coal compared with the carbon dioxide emissions when you burn natural gas to get the same amount of energy, but that's only part of the story because, again, natural gas is mostly methane. You can't develop and use that without having some of it emitted unburned to the atmosphere. And small amounts, you know, a couple of percent of the fuel emitted unburned to the atmosphere add hugely to the greenhouse gas consequences. So, in fact, the best evidence is that the greenhouse gas footprint of natural gas and coal are about the same. So this whole idea that natural gas is a bridge fuel really has been debunked by the scientific literature 10 to 15 years ago. And the only reason we're still talking about it is that it's a great marketing ploy for oil and gas.
And we're talking about major methane emissions from liquefied natural gas. How much is that costing the U.S. when it comes to its decarbonization goals?
Before 2016, it was illegal to export LNG. Industry lobbied hard to change the rules on there and allow us to export. We are by now by far the largest exporter of LNG in the world. About a quarter of all LNG movements in the world are coming from the United States. It has a large, large footprint. The methane emissions associated with that are a substantial reason that methane is increasing in the atmosphere globally, and that is adding substantially to the climate crisis that we find ourselves in. It sort of flies in the face of what we say in terms of our climate goals for us to become such a large petro and gas exporter.
You mentioned that there's been a huge expansion of liquefied natural gas, a liquefied natural gas export in the United States. What are some of the areas where these projects are located, and what impact have they had on surrounding communities?
Almost all of the increase in LNG exports from the United States have come from our Gulf Coast, from ports in Louisiana and Texas. The communities there are feeling it. These are large industrial plants. They have large local pollution sources. There are large ships coming in to be filled and taken away, and there are emissions associated with those ships as well. So if you talk to the local people who live in this area, they are not fans at all of this technology. They really want it to stop. If you look at where the gas for that's coming from, it's almost all shale gas, and it's largely coming from the Permian Basin in Texas, somewhat in New Mexico, and similar basins in Louisiana and other parts of Texas, and locally in those gas fields, too. This is an incredibly energy-intensive industrial process with large local emissions, which local people feel.
What sort of health issues do local communities usually experience if they're next to an LNG project?
Studies show if you live nearby to one of these drilling rigs, you have a significantly lower life expectancy and you are more likely to suffer a variety of diseases. Other hydrocarbons which are emitted to the atmosphere unburned, things like benzene, toluene, these are carcinogens. They're mutagens. They cause birth defects. They cause cancer. And again, when you burn it, you're producing nitrogen oxides are a big problem, sulfur oxides. And these are huge health irritants. They aggravate lung diseases, they aggravate asthma, they aggravate cardiac diseases. So there's a significant impact on the local community near these LNG facilities and, again, in the drilling facilities.
And, Professor, what would you say to someone who says that LNG is essential for the energy transition?
For anyone to say that LNG is essential to an energy transition is speaking nonsense, quite frankly. Let me be completely blunt. We need to be moving away from fossil fuels, and the way to move away from fossil fuels is to base our electricity on renewable sources, wind, solar, hydro, with appropriate storage, and battery storage and thermal storage are becoming far more effective and far cheaper every single day. They're being massively employed. It's already cheaper in most countries to generate new electricity with solar or wind than it is with new natural gas. So the future is not with natural gas in any case. But LNG is just an expensive, energy-intensive, polluting way of moving gas across oceans. It's not the way forward for any sensible energy plan. The argument I have heard is that, well, we need to do it to help our friends in Europe because of the crisis of the Russian attack on Ukraine. And for sure, that was a big disruption in their use of natural gas, and LNG exports from the U.S. did help on a short-term basis for them to get through that first winter or two. But Europe has been moving very rapidly away from natural gas. They have no growing demand for our natural gas. Their gas demand is decreasing. Their energy production, electric production, is overwhelmingly moving to renewable sources, and they have deployed heat pumps at an unprecedented level so that their use of natural gas in heating has dropped precipitously over the last 2 years. They've set a model for how the whole world can move towards decarbonization that we should all pay attention to and follow. And trying to dump more LNG on them is counterproductive to what we need and what they are doing.
Robert Howarth is professor of ecology and environmental biology at Cornell University. Thanks for joining us.
It's been great to be here. Thank you.
Steel is a modern-day necessity and a huge climate problem. It goes into everything from washing machines to buildings. And making steel accounts for 10% of all carbon dioxide emissions worldwide. But in Sweden, some companies have found a way to cut steel's carbon footprint down to almost nothing. Reid Fraser of the Allegheny Front went there to see this transition firsthand.
On a bright October afternoon, Anne Graf hops into the back seat of a Toyota pickup truck.
So, what are we doing? We're putting our seatbelts on and we're driving out onto the site.
Graf is with the Swedish company Stegra. She's showing me the company's big construction site here near Boden, Sweden, just below the Arctic Circle.
The world's first large-scale green steel production facility.
The 600-acre site is surrounded by forest. It's a nearly $7 billion project. Graf says the fossil-free steel made here will be the same as what's produced at traditional mills.
So it will become cars, trucks, construction materials. It will become dishwashers and fridges and freezers. And I think steel is all around us in our everyday. Once you start thinking about how much steel you see or use in a day, you'll be surprised.
Basically, all the stuff that makes modern life possible will be made here. But the way most steel is made now, all that stuff comes with a heavy climate price. Steelmakers have been using the same basic recipe for hundreds of years. They heat up iron ore in a blast furnace with a refined coal known as coke. Carbon from the coal reacts with oxygen in the iron ore, creating lots of carbon dioxide, or CO2. But instead of coal, Stegra will use hydrogen, a common industrial gas. This way, the biggest byproduct is hydrogen plus oxygen, H2O.
It's, in a very concrete way, we are physically going to remove CO2 emissions by providing better steel.
And by better, she means cleaner. Scientists have known hydrogen could be used to make steel for decades, but it's hard to work with and more expensive than coal. Plus, most hydrogen today comes from fossil fuels in a process that leads to a lot of carbon pollution. Stegra will produce its hydrogen out of water using renewable energy, significantly cutting its CO2 footprint.
What you're doing is essentially replacing a coal mine with a facility that uses electricity and water.
Other steel companies in Sweden are also starting to work with hydrogen. The steelmaker Ovako recently converted some of its furnaces from natural gas to hydrogen.
It was very hard.
Michael Persson of Ovako managed the project.
I've never done this. Nobody has ever done that. So we went into it with a blindfolded.
His team spent 4 years building a hydrogen plant inside an old steel mill. Persson leads me inside.
Yeah, this is the plant.
Persson takes me into a large white room. Inside are 8 cylindrical tanks. Picture huge AA batteries, larger than a tractor trailer, each laid on their sides. An electric current courses through each tank, separating water molecules into oxygen and hydrogen.
The current is really, really, really high. So the power needed as a maximum is for the whole plant is what we call 20 megawatt.
That's a lot of juice, enough to power 10,000 homes in the U.S. The company can use this much electricity with very little climate impact. That's because Sweden's electric grid is almost entirely carbon-free. The country relies mostly on hydroelectric and nuclear plants, not fossil fuels. But what's really driving this investment in green steel now? Money. In Europe, it's about to get much more expensive to make steel the old-fashioned way. Max Oman is a professor at Lund University in Sweden.
The EU system for putting a price on carbon has actually started to work.
The European Union has a carbon trading system that taxes companies for emitting greenhouse gases. It's set to impose a larger penalty on traditional steelmakers in the next decade.
With that price on CO2, then suddenly actually green steel from hydrogen is more or less competitive.
Car makers like Volvo and BMW have lined up to buy green steel in Sweden to meet their own climate goals. Lars Nilsson, also of Lund University, says this outcome seemed a long shot a decade ago. That's when he started working on a project with another Swedish company on a hydrogen pilot project completed in 2021.
I remember other big steel companies sort of laughing at it, you know, this is just fairy tales. But I think it's quite real. It's, you know, you can discuss technology readiness, but it's not a giant technological leap.
And dozens of similar projects are in the works around the world. Nilsson says Sweden is proving green steel is possible, but to make it work elsewhere, the industry needs lots of affordable clean energy and policies like a carbon tax that will help it compete with traditional steel. For Living on Earth, I'm Reid Fraser in Boden, Sweden.
Reid's reporting was made possible by the MIT Environmental Solutions Journalism Fellowship.
Just ahead, the U.S. Postal Service goes electric. Keep listening to Living on Earth.
I want to tell you about one of Living on Earth's sponsors, but right away, I want to share the special offer to LOE listeners. Today, you can receive 20% off any AquaTrue water purifier. Just go to AquaTrue.com, that's AquaTrue.com, and enter code EARTH at checkout. That's 20% off any AquaTrue purifier when you go to AquaTrue.com and use promo code EARTH. We're all always looking for ways to make safe drinking water easier because we know that drinking water is so important to staying hydrated and healthy. Did you know that 60% of your body is made out of water? But if you're like me, it's probably getting harder and harder to trust your tap water. Having safe, clean water is the last thing you want to worry about. But unfortunately, according to the Environmental Working Group, 3 out of 4 homes in America have harmful tap water contaminants. But AquaTrue can help. AquaTrue's reverse osmosis process removes 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters and are specifically designed to combat harmful chemicals like PFAS in your water supply. Plus, their easy-to-set-up countertop purifiers work with no installation, no plumbing. And just one set of filters makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water, which works out to less than 3 cents a bottle. And you'll also save the environment from tons of plastic waste. Also, AquaTrue is portable, making it perfect for renters or college dorm room dwellers. And best of all, the water tastes fantastic. Even pets can tell the difference. Your pets will love drinking AquaTrue water, and they'll be healthier for it. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it makes a great gift. One last reminder about our special offer. Today, LOE listeners receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. Just go to AquaTrue.com, that's AquaTrue.com, and enter code EARTH at checkout. As we approach the end of 2024, we wanted to take a moment to thank you and all of our listener supporters. You make the difference. Listener support makes this Living on Earth podcast possible. So thank you. To renew your gift or to give for the first time, visit loe.org.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Jenny Doring.
And I'm Paloma Beltran. As Catholics around the world turn their eyes to the Vatican before the celebration of the 2025 Jubilee begins on December 24th of this year, they'll see Pope Francis in a brand new electric Popemobile. The one-of-a-kind Mercedes-Benz will eventually be joined by many other EVs, as the Vatican plans to make all its vehicles emission-free by 2030. This is a logical next step after Pope Francis' climate change encyclical Laudato Si, published in 2015, and his follow-up Laudato Deum, both of which have made a theological case for climate action. But the Vatican isn't alone in going electric with its new fleet. The United States Postal Service began the rollout of new mail delivery vehicles earlier this year, most of which are electric. These cars replace the aging USPS fleet, whose design dates back to the 80s, and are drawing attention for their driver-friendly features, like air conditioning, safety improvements, and ergonomic seating, but also for their unusual design. With a tall roof and relatively flat hood, the new vehicles look remarkably similar to a duck's head. To talk more about these EVs and what they might mean for the industry, Living on Earth's Ainsley O'Neill called up our car expert, Jim Motovalli, who writes about green transportation for AutoWeek and Barron's.
So our news peg for this story is that the Vatican has this new electric Popemobile. And I'll be entirely honest, Jim, we partially just wanted to do this so that we could say Popemobile a bunch. What is your perspective on the Vatican taking a step like this towards sustainability?
Well, I believe they've said they want all the Vatican fleet to be electric by 2030, I think was the date. Yeah, it's a very good step they would take. And of course, it's in the air in Europe because all of Europe is going to be banning internal combustion basically by 2035. And now in England, they're talking about doing it by 2030. You know, the Pope would pretty much have to be driving an electric car pretty soon. But I think there's been some consideration under the current Pope of not driving a really ostentatious vehicle. Of course, so this one is a Mercedes-Benz, probably costs millions to make, so.
And we're talking about Europe, but there's a little bit of this going on in the U.S. too. We're also looking at these postal service duck cars. And for our listeners, they're called that because they have a sort of a tall head and flat bill like a duck. And the postal service is rolling them out, and some big percentage of them are EVs, with all of them eventually going to be EVs by, I think they said, 2026. What do you think of the design on those, Jim, and also that move from the U.S. Postal Service?
Well, this has been a long time coming. The contract to build these we almost called it a Popemobile there. They look kind of like Popemobiles, actually. The award to build these Postal Service vehicles has been in process for more than 10 years. And the vehicles are very ungainly looking, undoubtedly. They are not handsome vehicles. But what makes them not attractive is the very big windows. And that is being met very well by the postal drivers. They like them. They think they're really fun to drive. They like the EVs. They're quiet. And they're replacing some really outdated Jeeps and other vehicles. So they're very happy with them so far, from what I understand. There was a lot of debate over what percentage of the vehicles would be electric. And some of the contenders for the contract would have built all EVs. But currently, it's going to be a certain number, and it seems to be fluctuating how many of them will be EVs. But actually, the duty of delivering mail is perfect for electric vehicles because it's a lot of stop and go, and that allows you to use regenerative braking, and your range would be pretty good. For EVs, this is the perfect use case, actually.
And I mean, you joked that they kind of look like Popemobiles, but as I was looking into them, figuring out why that design was so weird, it's something like they've got to make sure that the shortest driver can see over the hood, but that the tallest driver can stand up in the back to gather the mail. And so those of us at the Living on Earth offices have been joking that it's a really big year for EVs that you can stand up in, because the Pope is also going to be standing up in his Popemobile.
It's funny, I just saw an exhibit of vehicles that were built for the King and Queen of England that was touring around the U.S., and they're very similar to the Popemobile. They have like, what do you call it, a reviewing platform for the dignitary to stand up and acknowledge the crowds.
Now, I don't know about Vatican fleet numbers, but it is something like tens of thousands of postal service vehicles that are now going to be these little duck cars. My question for you, Jim, is to what extent do you think that these statements are sort of showing a trend towards a tipping point for EV acceptance?
I think it's helping. I mean, there's a lot in the news today that's saying that EV sales have tanked. They often put it that way. They use dramatic language to say they're in the toilet or whatever. This is not actually true. The rate of EV adoption has slowed a bit, but it's still climbing. And some of the EV companies are having their best sales year in terms of selling EVs. So the adoption rate is still climbing. And it's funny, there are parts of the world where not having an EV is novel. And one of them is Norway, where the 95% of new car sales are EVs. And Iceland is another country that's nearing 90% EV adoption. In the U.S., I don't know, we're around 10% now, but 10% is better than 7%, is better than 6%, which wasn't a few years ago. So I think people are a little impatient to see EVs take over. But if you look at when we switched from horses to cars, that was like a 30-year process. So in, say, 1920, you can look at pictures of what was on the road, and you'll see horse-drawn carts still being used. So we're in that stage now. If you take a picture of the traffic stream, 1 in 10 cars might be an EV. Or if you're in California, it's going to be more than that. And, you know, there's pockets of acceptance, and they're in places you wouldn't expect. Florida's very high in EV adoption. Texas is, and the coasts.
Well, Jim, for our listeners who might be themselves considering an EV, what do you think is one thing that they need to keep in mind about the impact of going electric?
One thing you should remember is that people get anxious about the public charging network, and there's a reason for that. But 80% of your charging is going to be at home. So if you have a good situation at home, if you have an EV charger, if you have a garage, it's really helpful. Or just a way of putting an EV charger on the wall of your house. You're going to do most of your charging there. For one thing, it's a lot cheaper. I paid at one of the public charging networks I used when I was driving up the coast. I was paid 57 cents a kilowatt hour at an Electrify America station. And that's really high. You have a really good incentive to charge at home. And you're going to be able to do that most of the time. So you really shouldn't have as much worry about charging as people do. And the prices are down very much, and there's lots of good choice now. There's dozens of EVs on the market and more coming out every day. So I think there's some excellent choices people can make with an EV right now.
That's Jim Montevalli, author of High Voltage and blogger with Auto Week and Barron's. He spoke with Living on Earth's Ainsley O'Neill, who joins us now for more on this story. Hi, Ainsley. And what, if anything, do we know about how the incoming Trump administration feels about these new U.S. Postal Service EVs? I mean, Donald Trump hasn't exactly been singing the praises of electric vehicles.
Well, Jenny, you've got that right. I read an article out of Reuters that says that the Trump transition team is looking at canceling the USPS EV contracts, which include deals with Oshkosh and Ford. And it also sounds like they're talking about getting rid of the $7,500 EV tax credits that President Biden created with the Inflation Reduction Act, if Reuters sources are correct.
Huh, that's kind of perplexing, isn't it, that the Trump team is so anti-EV subsidy? After all, Tesla CEO Elon Musk has become very close to the president-elect.
I know, Paloma, it does seem that way at first glance. But here's the thing. Canceling the EV tax credits could actually be pretty good for Tesla and Musk. The company already has a huge foothold in the EV market, with around half of all U.S. electric vehicle sales in recent months. And by the way, it's gotten there in part thanks to the EV tax credits. No other car company has benefited more from these subsidies, and they've helped Tesla pull ahead of the pack of other automakers on EV sales. So Elon Musk told shareholders in July that ditching the EV tax credit could hold other companies back while Tesla coasts on all its momentum.
Ah, well, there it is. You know, Jim Montevalli mentioned there are some U.S. EV makers that are doing well despite a slight dip in the overall rate of EV growth. So Tesla must be one of those. Which others are doing well at this point?
Yeah, Tesla is still on top, but GM and Chevrolet EVs are selling well too.
So no wonder we're seeing more and more electric cars on the roads these days.
Yep, and one of them might be coming to a post office near you. But no telling when we'll see the Popemobile come around. There's only one Popemobile, after all.
Ah, you really did just want an excuse to say Popemobile a bunch on the show.
Oh, just a little bit.
Thanks, Ainsley.
Anytime.
Most of the 21 new cardinals Pope Francis elevated to the elite body on December 7th now have the honor of wearing the traditional scarlet vestments. But two in the Dominican order chose to continue to wear simple white robes. And when it comes to cardinals that fly, you might be surprised to learn that they don't all dress in red either. Ariana Remmel has this bird note.
Northern cardinals are known for their iconic red feathers. Males are bright scarlet, and females sport red wing and crest feathers. So if you saw a northern cardinal that was lemon yellow, you might think it was a different species entirely. In fact, these are northern cardinals, but with a genetic mutation. All cardinals ingest yellow pigments in their food. Most cardinals' bodies change them into red pigments, giving their feathers their signature shade. But just a few cardinals lack this ability, resulting in a bright yellow bird. Unexpectedly yellow birds occur in other species too, from house finches that look like they've been dipped in egg yolk to red-bellied woodpeckers with golden-hued head feathers. The condition is called xanthochromism. Xanthochromism and other color abnormalities are rare, just a handful in every few million bird sightings. And the causes for these conditions vary. For house finches, diet alone is probably enough to turn them yellow. Field guides show only a few illustrations for a single species, but part of the fun is finding all the shades of variation in well-known birds. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
For pictures, flap on over to the Living on Earth website, loe.org.
If you enjoy the stories you hear from Living on Earth, please consider signing up for our newsletter. You'll never miss a show, and you'll have special access to show highlights, notes from our staff, and advance information about upcoming live virtual events. The Living on Earth newsletter is sent to your inbox weekly. Don't miss out. Subscribe at the Living on Earth website, loe.org. That's loe.org. Coming up, a sacred river in India is polluted by raw sewage and detergents. Stay tuned to Living on Earth.
Support for Living on Earth comes from Sailors for the Sea and Oceana, helping boaters race clean, sail green, and protect the seas they love. More information at sailorsforthesea.org.
As we ring in the new year, we wanted to take a moment to thank you and all of our donors. Listener support makes this Living on Earth podcast possible, so thank you! If you've been considering LOE as part of your annual giving, there's still time to renew your gift or to donate for the first time. Visit loe.org.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Paloma Beltran.
And I'm Jenny Doring. India is home to mighty rivers that are the lifeblood of its economy and food system, and are worshipped by some as sacred. The holy Yamuna River serves some 57 million people, but around New Delhi, it has become choked with a thick off-white foam that's in part the result of detergents flowing untreated from laundries and households. And that's just the most visible pollutant. Raw sewage is contaminating the Yamuna River with high levels of fecal coliform. Despite government warnings about the health risks, some Hindu worshippers are wading in anyway in hopes of cleansing their sins. Susmita Sengupta covers water pollution as senior program manager for the Center for Science and Environment and joins me now from Delhi. Welcome to Living on Earth.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So first, what and where is the Yamuna River?
Yamuna River actually flows through Delhi, so it's very important for Delhi because our major drinking water supply is coming from Yamuna. Yamuna is also a tributary of our national river Ganga and feeds into the other states also, Uttar Pradesh in the downstream and Haryana in the upstream. But although it's just a very small fraction of Yamuna that is flowing into Delhi, 80% of the polluted stretch is in the capital city of Delhi.
Wow. And we've seen these pictures. One of the most striking visuals we've seen is the foam that's covering parts of the river around New Delhi. What exactly is this foam?
Before telling that, let me tell you that Delhi as a city is 50% sewered, which means that the households, they whatever sewage they are generating, or only 50% of it is connected to the sewage treatment plants and can go there and get treated. So remaining 50% is actually dumped in different open natural drains. We have more than 20 natural drains which are supposed to carry the rainwater. But due to the absence of proper sewer in the city, the sewage also gets dumped into the same open natural channels along with the rainwater. So I should tell you that for Yamuna's pollution, the domestic sewage is the most important pollution that is entering into the river. The Ganga and its tributaries, they get polluted due to industrial waste in the upper stretches. Also in the lower stretches near Kanpur, which is actually marked as a pollution hub. But in Delhi, it's mostly the domestic sewage. Now what happens is there are some open laundries which actually use detergents. And there are also the houses which are using detergents. So as a result, the phosphates that are generated are flowing into the river. And the foam is because of that phosphates.
And how much farming is there around this region? And how much is fertilizer or other products from farms getting into the river as well?
There is a big part where farming is getting done on the Yamuna floodplains, and chemical fertilizers are being used, although there is a good awareness about this fertilizer and people are moving into organic fertilizers. But still, there is a huge part of farmers who believe in this chemical fertilizers. And as a result, some nitrates also get into this river due to the chemical fertilizers.
So how is all of this pollution impacting the river's ecosystem and the communities that depend on it for their livelihoods?
The pollution in Delhi is very high. 80% of the pollution is happening only in Delhi. And Delhi, on the other hand, they actually get the whole of the drinking water supply from this river. Now, what is happening if you get your river polluted, then the cost of the water treatment becomes high, very high. If raw sewage is entering, what happens? A fecal coliform, which is actually getting into the river. So it's very high. The permissible limit is 2500 MPN per 100 milliliter. But it's actually in millions. The river enters into Delhi near Palla, where you will find that the fecal coliform is slightly low, but not within the permissible limit. But as it enters into the city, you will see the fecal coliform very high. And also, there are some religious programs around this river, because in India, we also worship the river. As a result, when people go and take a bath, it's not fit for open bathing also. The quality has deteriorated to that level that it's not permissible for outdoor bathing. So that also affects the health of the people.
Did I just hear you correctly? You said that the levels of fecal coliform are in the millions when they really should be more in the thousands. And yet, as you mentioned, this river is considered sacred. Can you tell us more about the cultural practices and why people have such a close relationship with this river?
Reason behind that every city had a river or a pond or a lake around which the city grew up, and all the needs of that city for water actually came from this water body. So since they were relying on these water bodies, they began worshipping it. So bathing, why bathing? Because people think, since they actually worship these water bodies, and since it's always compared to one's mother, so people think that when you take a dip in the river, then your sins are actually washed away.
Now, what are the health risks that we know about of coming into contact with this foam and with this pollution in the river?
So if people take dip in this river, then obviously there are skin problems, because as I told you, the detergents are actually released. So you have a skin problem. And during swimming and taking a dip in the river, some part of water, if it gets into your intestine, then intestinal problems also take place. And because nitrates, phosphates, fecal coliform, you name it and it's there.
In your view, what are the most practical and impactful solutions to help restore the Yamuna River?
We are telling that in the set of recommendations, use these open channels itself as your treatment areas. You locally treat it. You don't carry it to the centralized treatment systems, but locally you use low cost, maybe a reed bed. You can use a reed bed. To give you an example, you use a community of microbes to treat it locally, and you treat the water to a level which can be used for non-potable purpose, so that you do not send any fecal coliform laden or any polluted water into the river. You can have it at a community level, you can have it as an institutional level, so that you do not send polluted water to the river. And then secondly, we are saying that make your sewage treatment plants very close to the rivers, so that there is no chance of mixing of your whatever is coming out as treated from the sewage treatment plants and getting mixed with the untreated sewage in the river. And means we are promoting circular economy, where we are saying that whatever is coming out of your sewage treatment plants, the treated water, make use of it. Use that treated water. You can use it in your horticulture, you can use it in your park. So there is no mixing and all your treated water gets used up.
Susmita Sengupta is the Senior Program Manager for the Center for Science and Environment. Thank you so much, Susmita.
And thank you for bringing in such an important topic on the table.
By the way, India has a National Green Tribunal, also called its Green Court, that handles environmental pollution complaints, including the problems on the Yamuna River. Earlier this year, the Green Court documented a lack of sewage treatment in the city of Agra on the banks of the Yamuna and fined the local infrastructure agency nearly $7 million for failing to provide adequate sewage treatment. The Supreme Court of India recently upheld the fine, and in November, the Green Court penalized Delhi's local water authority and municipal government, fining each around $3 million for letting sewage and stormwater drains mix and improperly covering drains, contributing to the Yamuna's pollution.
Here at Living on Earth, it's our tradition at this time of holidays and solstice to step back from the pressing and sometimes depressing environmental news to share some tales and music with you, much as we might with our own families. And our holiday season special is next week. Right now, here's a preview from storyteller Noah Baum. She joined Living on Earth host and executive producer Steve Kerwood to share a tale from Afghanistan about how to find happiness.
There once was a king who disguised himself as a beggar and would roam the streets of his kingdom to listen to the people, to see how they live, for he had everything but he wasn't happy. He was always consumed by worry and he wanted to see how others live. And one night, as he was disguised as a beggar, wandering through the streets, he came to a place in the outskirts where he'd never been before. The streets became so narrow, they were alleyways, and the houses looked like they were going to fall. It was the Jewish neighborhood, the poorer neighborhood. And as he walked through those run-down streets, he suddenly heard someone singing a very joyous tune. The king was so surprised. Who could be so happy in such dismal-looking surroundings? And so he followed the singing and he came to a tumble-down hut. He knocked on the door, he asked, "Is a guest welcome here?" And the door flew open, an elderly Jew stood there with a beaming face. "A guest is a gift from God. Come in." And he welcomed the king into that hut as if it was a palace. There was not much there. Straw mat in the corner with a blanket. There was a table, one chair. Upon the table, the remains of a very humble meal. Tail end of a fish, crust of some dark bread, a little bit of wine. But the man invited the king in and insisted that he sit upon that one chair and partake from the remains of the meal. And after the king ate, he said, "Was it you singing? You sounded so happy." "Oh, yes, I have nothing to complain about." "And what is it that you do? How do you earn a living?" "I am a cobbler. I fix shoes for people by the side of the road." "Oh, And is that enough to sustain you? Yes, why not? Every day I work, I make enough for my meal, I eat, and I sing. The king was so surprised. He's never met anyone like this. He said, but don't you worry about the future? Don't you worry about tomorrow? Oh, no, said the Jew. I do not worry about something that hasn't happened yet. Besides, I have someone who takes care of me. Ah, thought the king, the mystery is solved. So, he asked, you have a family that takes care of you. No, my family is long gone. So who is it? Is it the king, perhaps? I heard he's very good to his citizens. Yes, the king is good to his citizens, but for me, the Almighty takes care of me day by day. The king left that place perplexed. How can someone who has so little be filled with so much joy? He was determined to get to the bottom of this. He would put the faith of that Jew to a test. And so the following day, he sent out a decree forbidding all cobblers from fixing shoes by the side of the road. And as he put on his beggar's disguise that evening, he thought to himself, we'll see what tune he'll sing this time when things are really bad. But what was his surprise as he entered those narrow alleyways when he heard, hey, and once again he was welcomed into that tumble-down hut as if it was a palace, and there were the remains of a humble meal upon the table, tail end of a fish, a crust of bread, a little bit of wine. And when the king ate, he said, but how did you manage this? I heard the king came out with a very cruel decree. Ah, yes, said the cobbler. When I came today and saw that decree, I closed my eyes and I prayed. I said, dear God, you see that the livelihood has been taken from my mouth. But I know that when you close one door, you open another. And when I opened my eyes, I saw a group of woodcutters going to the woods. They let me join them. I borrowed an axe. I got myself a nice bundle. I sold it in the marketplace, and with the money, I had enough for my meal. But what about tomorrow? What about when you're too old to hold an axe? Don't you worry about that. Oh, I told you yesterday, I do not worry about something that hasn't happened yet. Besides, I have the one who takes care of me day by day. The king was determined to get to the bottom of this. This could not be real. No one can have such faith. And so the following day, all the woodcutters were drafted into the king's guards. They were given a uniform, they were given a sword, but they were told that they will only be paid in 30 days. That night, the cobbler turned woodcutter, returned home. He had a little bit left from the night before, but he knew he did not have enough to sustain him for 30 days. And then he took out the sword from its sheath, and he examined it. It was a fine blade, the kind that only the king's guards receive. He went out, he cut a limb from one of the trees, and he sat up all night. And he fashioned an identical blade made of wood. He put it in the sheath, and the king's blade he sold in the market, and the money, oh, it was enough for more than 30 days. The following night, the king once again put on his beggar's disguise. He was certain that he will not hear anyone sing tonight. But what was his amazement when he heard? And when the king heard what the cobbler did, he said, But aren't you afraid? Oh, what if there's a sword inspection tomorrow? You could be executed for selling the king's blade. I told you, I do not worry about something that hasn't happened yet. Besides, I have the one who takes care of me day by day. The next day, the captain of the guards caught a man in the marketplace. He called forth the Jew. He said, "This man is a thief. By the order of the king, you must cut off his head now." The Jew fell upon his knees. "Oh, please, can you choose someone else? I'm an observant Jew. I cannot take the life of another human being." "It is the order of the king. If you refuse, it is your head that's on the line." The crowd was gathering. The Jew closed his eyes. He prayed a little. He thought a little. And then he opened his eyes. He stood up and he looked up into the heavens and he spoke in a loud voice for all to hear. "Dear God," he said, "be my witness. Give me a sign. You see that I am ordered here to take the life of another human being, and you know that I have never even hurt a fly. Please, be my witness. If this man is indeed guilty of the crime that he is being accused of, give me the strength to take out my sword and cut his head off with one blow. But, dear God, if by any chance this man is innocent, give me a sign and turn my sword into wood." And with that, he pulled out his sword and lifted it up in the air. And the crowd gasped, for indeed it was made of wood. Some people fell upon their knees at the miracle they had just witnessed. But the king, watching it all from his balcony, smiled at the wisdom of that man. He came down and he said to him, "I am the guest that you have welcomed so generously into your home these last few nights. And now I'd like to ask you to come and be my guest. Live in the palace by my side. Be my advisor. Teach me how to live as you do, with so much faith and so much joy, day by day." And with that, they joined arms and went up the palace steps, singing. Hey.
Wow, that's a great, funny story.
It is.
Yeah, to have faith that says you have to maybe be a bit of a trickster at the same time, huh?
Absolutely. To have faith does not mean that you have to be blind or stop thinking. It just means that you have to believe that things are possible.
That's storyteller Noah Baum speaking with Living on Earth host Steve Kerwood. Tune in next week to hear more stories on our holiday season show. Living on Earth is produced by the World Media Foundation. Our crew includes Naomi Ehrenberg, Kayla Bradley, Josh Kroom, Daniela Faria, Mehek Gugneja, Swayam Gugneja, Mark Kausch, Mark Southlander, Don Lyman, Nana Mohammed, Ainsley O'Neill, Sophia Panalitis, Jake Rigo, Andrew Scarrett, and Ella Wilson.
Tom Tiger engineered our show. Allison Lurish-Dean composed our themes. You can hear us anytime at LOE.org, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube Music. And like us, please, on our Facebook page, Living on Earth. We tweet from @LivingOnEarth and find us on Instagram @LivingOnEarthRadio. And we always welcome your feedback at comments@loe.org. Steve Kerwood is our executive producer. I'm Paloma Beltran.
And I'm Jenny Doring. Thanks for listening.
Funding for Living on Earth comes from you, our listeners, and from the University of Massachusetts Boston, in association with its School for the Environment, developing the next generation of environmental leaders, and from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration in solving the world's most pressing environmental problems.
PRX.